As I had mentioned last week, today we are starting something new that will carry us through several weeks here at the beginning of this year. And we are following up on our studies of the books of Esther and also Ezra through a short series on now the book of Nehemiah. And of course, what all three of those have in common is that they relate to what the Lord was doing in and through his people in Old Testament times during the period that they were in exile, and particularly as the Lord brought them out of that period of judgment and gave them a new start in what we call the return or the restoration. And I don't know how familiar you are with the book of Nehemiah in particular, but at first glance, it might not seem very inviting. And as you think about a series on this book, you might scratch your head as to what the point is or what we could get out of this. A lot of this has to do with the building of walls around a city. And some of us have visited that city. On the screen in the back, you see a picture of the city of Jerusalem as it looks today. Didn't quite look that way at the time of Nehemiah. And it might interest us historically how those walls would have been built or rebuilt at this time, but it's not the sort of thing that most of us personally have been that concerned about, the walls around the city of Jerusalem hundreds or thousands of years ago. And furthermore, when you read this book, what you find is that 53% of the book's verses consist of lists, mostly lists of people's names who in some way or another were involved in that work of rebuilding those walls. And so we wonder why this book is in the Bible and what we could possibly gain from it in our much different lives today. Well, the other side is that through history, actually, many of God's people have found Nehemiah to be a deeply moving and instructive part of Scripture. I'll read you the testimony of one Christian leader. He says, "The details of my first meeting him," that is Nehemiah, "are hazy in my mind. God sent him to me during my early university years to help me overcome some formidable challenges, and he has been a close companion ever since." He goes on to describe the book of Nehemiah, and he speaks of it as a journal, or part of it as a journal, which that seems to be the nature of some of these passages. He says, "Nehemiah put his very being into his journal, which is incorporated into the book we now call by his name. As I read, I can feel his heartbeats. I can sense the trembling of his fingers and know the heaviness of his groans. What wisdom he had, and how he drummed the basic lessons of leadership into me. I have forgotten none of them and have gone back to him time and again for reassurance." And that has been the experience of many of God's people, particularly those called to spiritual leadership. My prayer is that we will experience something of that compelling influence that this man's life and this man's book has had on other people. And we do need to begin by reminding ourselves of the historical background of this exilic and this post-exilic period. And I put up here a list of dates that hopefully looks familiar because we have covered this before. It applied to Ezra and also to Esther. The start of this period was in the year 586 BC when out of the judgment of God and as a servant of God for that judgment, the pagan Babylonian emperor Nebuchadnezzar came in, destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and carted off the bulk of the people of Judah to exile in Babylon. And that period lasted some 70 years. There are different ways to count the 70 years, but the next big turning point would be when the next empire comes in, topples the Babylonians, establishes now the Persian influence over the ancient Near East, and their first king, we know him as Cyrus II. But he has a change of philosophy in how he governs. And he decides that, really out of a political motive, to get the people more on his side. He is going to give them permission to go back to their lands and to rebuild their civilizations as colonies, not as exiles. And that begins the process by which the people of God start returning to Judah to rebuild. The first wave of those returnees was led by a man named Zerubbabel, and the immediate purpose that he had before him in establishing that society, that people, was to rebuild the temple. And there were a lot of twists and turns that are recounted in the first part of Ezra about that temple, but finally the Lord enabled them to rebuild it in the year 516, and they celebrate the mighty working of God to give them that firm foothold back in the land of their fathers. We go on to read in the book of Esther, particularly, about a later situation, a later emperor of Persia. His name was Xerxes, and he was the one who ended up taking the Jewess Esther as his bride, and we know how the Lord used her over back over there in Persia to be protecting his people. So whether they were in their homeland or in the foreign land, God was clearly at work to preserve a remnant and to move forward his promises to the people of Israel. Then we come more to the period that we're concerned about this morning, and Emperor Artaxerxes I. He's the one that's ruling under both Ezra and Nehemiah. They both have significant interactions with this emperor. And Ezra goes back in the year 458, actually commissioned by Artaxerxes for the purpose of teaching the people of God their law. He's sent as a preacher. He's sent as a teacher. And we read about his ministry in the second part of the book that bears his name. Now we come to Nehemiah. And we're jumping ahead some 13 years to the year 445. And now we could call this the third wave of people going back. And they're led by Nehemiah to give attention to the walls that were there to protect, that should have been there to protect the people of God in the city of Jerusalem. So keep that in mind, and also keep this in mind, that Ezra and Nehemiah are co-laborers ultimately, and their ministries parallel each other in significant ways, and their books parallel each other in significant ways. Look at the breakdown of these books, where both of them have an opening section that is about something physical in nature. In the case of Ezra, it had to do with the rebuilding of the temple in chapters 1 to 6. In the case of Nehemiah, chapters 1 to 7 have to do with the rebuilding of the walls around the city. But then the focus shifts in the second half of each of these books to more the spiritual condition of God's people and a series of reforms that Ezra and then Nehemiah later carried out as a part of what the Lord had called them to do. It wasn't just about building buildings. It was about urging and helping the people to return to the Lord and to yield their lives in obedience to Him. And both of these books end up focusing on the spiritual part of the restoration in the second half. Now, both of those kinds of restoration were important in a general sense because God made certain promises to His people about that city, and He wanted to keep what He had said. But in a more specific sense, leading up to our lives, the Lord was working to move things forward to the ultimate fulfillment of His promises in the Messiah. And even though we don't see this by name in Ezra and Nehemiah, when we connect it with the rest of the canon and the rest of redemptive history, it is clear that this was a preparatory process to get things in place so that about 400 years later, Christ would come. And He is ministering in the same temple that these people had built. And He is walking around the same walls that these people had built. This was all moving the next step forward to the coming of the Messiah. And so the physical restoration was a part of that. The Lord having a people in place, having a society, having an organization, having a temple, having walls, having a city, in order for the Messiah to come and work out His ministry on our behalf. But the spiritual restoration is certainly more important than just having a place. And at this point in history, these men are raised up by God to address some very particular problems that have been developing among the people of God, even though they were physically back in place. The emphasis on the ongoing failures of God's people, the emphasis on human depravity, despite all the grace that God has shown them, again, that has a preparation part to it, where it is just driving home in one more way the desperate need that we all have for a Messiah who would deliver us, who would keep the law for us, because we keep failing, and the people failed again and again, even in these late periods leading up to Christ. In the case of Ezra, the focus, you might remember, was on this mixed marriage crisis, where violating very clear prohibitions and very, very convicting history as well, these people get involved in marriages with those who are outside of the people of God. Ezra comes on the scene to deal with that issue. Nehemiah has to deal with some of that as well, but his reforms are broader. There are other practical problems that develop that he has to contend with, things like the violation of the Sabbath law among these restored people. But another thing that distinguishes Nehemiah from Ezra is that this is a lot more personal an account. We get more a sense of the heart and the emotion and the struggle and the devotion of Nehemiah, since he gives us so much information about his own personal life, and he highlights as well the special role that the Lord had put him in as a leader over the people of God. And that leads us to what I think would be a helpful summary of the message of this book as a whole, and that is divine restoration through human leadership. In Ezra, we were looking at divine restoration and the responsibility that God's people had to maintain holiness as a part of restoration. That's here as well, but the broader focus is on how the Lord used Nehemiah to guide, to inspire, to organize, to build up the people of God as they are advancing the restoration. And so divine restoration through human leadership. Now, that process of restoration through human leadership begins in what is our text today, chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 8. And I'd like us to consider that passage this morning under the title, How God Begins to Do a Work. How God begins to do a work. This is just the beginning. We don't really learn about what actually Nehemiah does, or the problems he encounters, or the successes he has when he actually gets over there. This is just the start. And it is true that Nehemiah was a unique individual at a very special period of history. And what he experienced was unique to his circumstances and to his calling. And as we read a story like this, we don't want to assume that God is necessarily going to work in all of these ways or in exactly these ways in every situation that he may call any of us to do for him. But at the same time, I believe that what we see throughout this book does establish patterns. In other words, it shows us the kinds of ways in which God works to move forward his redemptive purposes and how he uses people in that process. And we know that these are patterns. In other words, there is a unique element, but these are nevertheless also applicable to a lot of other people. We know that because the same kinds of things the Lord does here through Nehemiah, we've actually seen him do already through Esther. And we have seen him do it as well through Ezra. And we can look at other Bible characters, and we can look at other figures in the history of the church. And we can look, I believe, at how the Lord guides us and raises us up and uses us from personal experience and see that these are repeated patterns in how the Lord tends to work among his people. And so there really is a lot for us to glean as we strive to serve the Lord in our generation, to carry out whatever our calling may be in his plan for our day to serve him in our world. So what are the steps that the Lord tends to follow when he intends to launch new waves of his redemptive work? What are the ways in which he works to raise up leaders to guide the people of God in that work? As we look at this passage, we see five steps that the Lord follows in this case that I think are instructive for how he generally tends to work. And here's how it begins in the first four verses, that God burdens his people about specific needs. God burdens his people about specific needs. Look with me there at Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Kislev in the 20th year, as I was in Susa, the citadel, same place where Esther carried out her work, that Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are destroyed by fire. And so this story begins when Nehemiah gets a report about the condition of God's people, the condition of the walls, and the condition of the people themselves as they were dealing with that issue, that they were filled with shame as they experienced great trouble. Now, what exactly is the wall crisis that he heard about here? It is possible that that refers to what Nebuchadnezzar had done when he destroyed Jerusalem. I mentioned that in connection with the year 586. But we have to realize that that happened 140 years before Nehemiah getting this report. It would not have been a surprise to him. It was not news to him that Nebuchadnezzar had done that and that there was all this devastation that came through the work of Nebuchadnezzar. That was ancient history as far as he's concerned. This seems to be something more pressing, something more immediate, something more recent related to the walls. And the more likely background is what we actually read about in Ezra chapter 4 that happened around this time under the reign of Artaxerxes. You can read about it starting in verse 8 of chapter 4. We won't take the time to do that. But to remind us of what was there, there were these two men, Rehum and Shimshai, among the enemies of God's people rebuilding. And they sent a letter to Artaxerxes, and they falsely warned him that the Judeans were intending to rebel against Persia. And you may remember that they were all about history, and they were claiming that throughout its history, this city has been rebellious and hasn't wanted to pay taxes or submit to its authorities. And Artaxerxes, you better put a stop to this, or they're going to rebel against you and damage your kingdom. And Artaxerxes apparently didn't do his homework, because the homework he did led him to the conclusion that this was a rebellious city, but there was a whole lot of other news to be aware of with that as well. And he impulsively responds by putting a stop to the work. He stops what they had begun. The temple would be finished in time, but as far as the walls are concerned and the other important parts of the restoration, it really came to a stop under the rule of Artaxerxes in this period. And evidently the enemies, people like Rehum and Shimshai, took advantage of the situation and they stepped in and destroyed what had already been built up to that point. So there was this partial wall around the city, and it seems that people like this took advantage of their position of prominence now with Artaxerxes and tore down and burned up the work that had just recently been done. And this is apparently the message that Nehemiah gets as to what was going on in his homeland. Now, how is he going to respond to that? And my point is that God starts this process by burdening this man about a very specific and pressing need among his people. And we read about that starting in verse 4. As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And you wonder how many days and how long was this man personally torn up and mourning? Well, he had just mentioned the month Kislev in chapter 2, verse 1, for the next major event in the story. He mentions the month of Nisan. And it's about 4 months, according to our reckoning of time, from Kislev to Nisan. And when he says that he wept and mourned for days, he's talking about something that went on for about 4 months. That's how devastated he is personally by the devastation of the walls of the city. I have mourned, and I have grieved over certain things that hurt me deeply. But 4 months is a long time. To have that level of emotional intensity about anything. And I can't say I can really relate, or that anything has ever touched me so profoundly that I could hardly carry out my duties because I was so overcome with sorrow for that length of time. And that was this man's experience. And what I'm saying about it is that the Lord was working through the sorrow in his heart. That wasn't just a personal struggle that we just needed to get over. It wasn't just the outpouring of his emotions that he needed to process and then be able to get on with his life. This was actually something the Lord was using to give him a vision, a burden, a passion to accomplish something about the problem that was such a burden to his heart. And one of the reasons I say that, I mean, I think we can infer that in general from reading the story, but one of the reasons I say that is because of how he puts it later in chapter 2. And you could jump ahead to 2 verse 12. When he gets to the city and first evaluates the situation, he says, I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. His burden over the problems of God's people, the Lord used to give him a desire that he could not shake off. I have to do something about this. The burden the Lord used to give him a call. Those are not the same things, but the one in the providence of God often leads to the other. And that should be no surprise, because when we read the book of Ezra and all of the very sometimes sacrificial things that these people had to do as they make this huge trip and start from scratch all over, what explains it? How did that all happen? We ran across that expression several times, that the Lord stirred up the people, or he stirred up their hearts to give them a desire for this project. And now we see the same kind of thing happening in the heart of Nehemiah. He is not the only one in whose life the Lord created a burden and used that burden to give him an impulse to do something about it. Think about our Savior and what are the kinds of things on his heart when he goes to the cross. What is his posture toward his people, most of whom are rejecting him even in that moment? We read, for example, in Luke chapter 19, verse 41-42, he's actually going to talk about a later destruction of the city of Jerusalem by the Romans in AD 70, so that what Nehemiah did accomplish ends up destroyed all over again. Jesus is thinking about that future event, and here's what he says. When he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it. That sounds like Nehemiah. Or maybe we could say Nehemiah sounds like Jesus ahead of time. And here's what he said as he wept. Would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace, but now they're hidden from your eyes. And he goes to the cross with a burden for his own people. And he knows that in the end, that's all going to be turned around because of his cross work. But this deep concern is one of the things that drives him. Or the Apostle Paul, as he thought about his own life and calling, even though the Lord had called him primarily to minister to Gentile people, remember what he says in Romans chapter 9, verse 1. I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart. For I could wish that I myself were accursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, my kinsmen according to the flesh. Again, I can't say I have ever been so burdened about somebody that I wished I would go to hell instead of them. But that is how deeply touched the Apostle Paul was. And the Lord used that emotional burden to drive him forward to do anything he possibly could do to give the gospel to the Jewish people. I don't think we can come close to the depth of concern that these individuals had, but do we know anything of it? What are we really troubled by as we look out on the world? And so often we are deeply troubled by ourselves and what we don't have that we want, and the problems in our personal lives or in our families. And that has a place in the plan of God, but God's plan is a lot bigger than that. What we see in Scripture is that the Lord works by deepening in people's hearts a burden about something bigger than themselves, problems that need addressed, needs that have to be met in order for the global plan of God to move forward in big ways and small ways. And he starts that work by really giving people a desire to see something fixed. Listen to E.M. Bounds challenge us about that. He says, how few the strong men in these days who can weep at the evils and abominations of the times. How rare those who, seeing the desolations of Zion, are sufficiently interested and concerned for the welfare of the church to mourn. Mourning and weeping over the decay of religion, the decline of revival power, and the fearful inroads of worldliness in the church. Mourning over that kind of stuff, that's almost an unknown quantity. And this was like 150 years ago that Bounds was just bewailing the lack of concern that even God's people had for God's things. But he says, in contrast to that, Nehemiah was a mourner in Zion. And this is how the Lord would work in our day as well, by burdening us about specific needs. So then what? What's the next step? How does the Lord work through that burden? It's very clear that the next step is that God stirs his people to pray. And Nehemiah makes that point as he continues in verse 4. I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Remember, that was his posture, fasting and praying for 4 months. And actually, this book reveals a great deal about the prayer life of Nehemiah. Just like about 53% of the verses are list, about 11% of the verses are prayers. This prayer that he shares, starting in verse 5, is the longest of those. It sets the tone for all of them, and it is exemplary as far as the approach that we make to the Lord as we seek him to do something about these things that are burdening us. What are the elements of this prayer? First of all, in verse 5, there is adoration of God's character. And here's what he says. O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments. I love how that introduction to his prayer brings together inseparably the transcendence of God and the immanence of God. Transcendence. God is the Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God, the God far away, huge, so different, so majestic. But immanence is his closeness to his people, and the fact that despite of how finite we are, how sinful we are, he has condescended to make a covenant with us as his people, and he's going to keep that covenant. And Nehemiah grabs on to that reality of the character of God, that he is a God of steadfast love. And then the next element of the prayer, moving on from adoration of God's character, is confession of sin, verses 6 to 7. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants. Okay, what is the prayer? Or listen to me. Here's the prayer. Confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you, even I and my father's house has sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. This man is not minimizing sin. He is not glossing over it just to get onto something else. He is not blame shifting. This confession is emphatic, and this confession is personal. He does pray on behalf of Israel, and there's this kind of corporate idea where he's in solidarity with the nation. But it's more than that. It's also personal because he says, I have played a role in the decline of this people. It's not just we, it is I and my father's house have sinned. He owns up to his part in the decline, and he confesses it openly and humbly. And this is part of why his heart is broken, that even after all the people of God have experienced, they continue to fail. And so confession of sin is part of the prayer that he lifts up. And then there is, number three, an appeal to the promises of God. An appeal to God's promises. Verse 8, remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, and notice their quotation marks, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. And that is a quotation from the covenant curses in the Pentateuch, and particularly Leviticus 26, 33, Deuteronomy 28, 64. His point is, we've been judged, and this wasn't an accident. This wasn't just that somehow Babylon or Persia developed more power than we have. You actually, Lord, were keeping your word. You were being faithful to something very specific you had said about cursing us as a nation if we should depart from you. But he goes on in verse 9, and he blends together with that statement another set of passages when he says, but if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell there. And that comes from Deuteronomy chapter 30, starting at verse 1. You know that you are on good ground to pray about something specific when you can show from Scripture something specific that God has said about that issue. When you can look at verses, you're so familiar with what's important to God and what he's promised to his people, what he's committed himself to do, that as you try to figure out how do I pray about a situation, we don't always know the way to do that, but we're on solid ground when we can tie it to specific things that God has said he's concerned about and he's committed to. And that's what Nehemiah does here. And then in verse 10, he ties it all back to the even longer history of God's working to show grace and faithfulness to his people, all the way back to the Exodus. He says, they, that is God's people, the people of Israel, they are your servants and your people whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. And by alluding to that past event, he is expressing faith that God continues to have the same power available to him in this generation to do whatever kind of maybe Exodus-like thing the people of God need today. And it reminds the Lord as well that there is an inseparable connection between the current generation of Jewish people and all earlier Israelites. Lord, you did it for them. You brought them through so many things. Are you going to just let all that fizzle out now? after all the investment you've made in the past, after staking your character and your faithfulness and all this, are you just going to let it fall to the ground? Surely, you're not going to abandon us now. We're your people. You brought us out of Egypt. You worked on our behalf so many other times. And he's appealing to the Lord's commitments. And then finally, in the prayer, and almost to the end of chapter 1, the last element is supplication on behalf of God's cause. We have little formulas for our prayers. ACTS, perhaps, you know, adoration, confession, thanksgiving, supplication. If you wonder where those kind of formulas come from, this isn't quite that, but actually you have prayers of the Bible that you can analyze to figure out what goes on in a biblical prayer. In this case, it's adoration, confession, appeal to God's promises, focusing on his faithfulness, and then very earnestly this supplication. He says, verse 11, O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name, and give success to your servant today, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. Now, a few verses earlier, in chapter 1, verse 8, when he was talking about some of the Lord's promises, he spoke about the place where the temple was or would be, and God said about that place, that's where I'm going to make my name dwell. And that's what makes it so special in the earth, that my name or my character or the reputation of my character is bound up with this city and this temple. And now he says, as he describes his own prayer and apparently others that he had talked to about this and that were of the same heart with him, he describes them as people who delight to fear your name. Kind of a odd combination of ideas. Normally we think of fear as a negative thing. We don't like to fear. And there's a negative fear that doesn't apply to the Lord. But there is an appropriate fear of holding him in high esteem, revering him, loving his glory, not wanting to do anything that would displease him. And he says, I actually delight to have this attitude of fear before you. And it's to fear your name. And he's connecting that, I think, with what he said before about the name that God would make dwell in Jerusalem. He's saying, Lord, I revere what is important to you. What's special to you, your name, is also special to me. I care about the same thing. And this is what I'm praying for. I'm not praying primarily, Lord, rebuild the walls so that we are physically protected, as important as that was. But it's, Lord, rebuild the walls so that your name is exalted. Your reputation is on the line here. The nations of the world are mocking those who claim to be your worshipers when they can't even build a wall around their city. Lord, your name is on the line here. I love your name. You love your name. Work for your name. Here's a statement about his posture, his attitude in prayer. Nehemiah's walk with God was saturated with his praying, and praying of the truest and purest kind. The sort of praying that is always seeking to clarify its own vision of who and what God is, and to celebrate his reality in constant adoration, and to rethink in his presence such needs and requests as one is bringing to him, so that the stating of them becomes a specifying of, here's the Lord's Prayer, hallowed be thy name, thy will be done, thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. This request is all contributing to the hallowing of the name of God in the world. And so we find that God moves this man from a burden to an impassioned and very detailed and very God-centered and very specific kind of prayer. And that prayer ends with, grant him mercy in the sight of this man. The last words there of the passage we were looking at in chapter 11. And if you were reading this for the first time, you would wonder, where did that come from? What is he talking about? who is this man? This man has not been introduced. And right away, as if to anticipate that that would be the question, and you know, they're sort of creating a little suspense and then immediately answering it, he goes on to finish verse 11 by saying, "Now I was a cupbearer to the king." You didn't know that before. "Now I was a cupbearer to the king." That's the man that I'm praying God would work in his heart too about this issue. And that brings us to this third consideration of how the Lord begins to do a work, is that God opens opportunities for his people. It's no coincidence that he had that particular position of cupbearer. And that was a position of special trust in the empire. To be a cupbearer was not simply to be a butler or to be a taste tester. It was the responsibility to drink ahead of the king to make sure the wine wasn't poison and wasn't going to harm him or kill him, which was no small concern if you know anything about the intrigue of these pagan courts and how the emperors were regularly attacked, including by their own families. And the emperor had to trust that the cupbearer himself wasn't a traitor, wasn't somehow going to deceive him. This was a position of great responsibility that communicated a lot of personal reliance. He was kind of like a bodyguard, in a sense. And you can imagine why, given the closeness of that relationship, over time that cupbearer would become a kind of friend or even a confidant to the emperor and have a special connection with maybe special favors that went back and forth. And that's just where Nehemiah happened to be. How did an exiled Jew like Nehemiah end up in such a high position in a Gentile court? I have no idea. But I do know the Lord did very similar things with Daniel and Esther and Ezra in the same time period, elevating Jewish people to positions of connections, we would call them, and of influence with those who were ruling the world, humanly speaking. God is more than capable of directing the paths of his people to the specific places and relationships they are going to need in order to carry out the work that he has designed for them individually. And so as you think about your own role and maybe things that the Lord might have you do, consider, what relationships do I have? What connections do I have? What roles do I have? What skills do I have? What kinds of things has the Lord put in my hand to suit me to do a particular thing for him? They may not be as big or dramatic as Nehemiah, but they are nevertheless part of how God providentially gives you appointments personally, and it matters to him that you and I are faithful with whatever he has put in our hands. This is part of his work. He opens up those opportunities. Number four, and into chapter two, God enables his people to take appropriate action. Those 4 months went by, and now we're going to see how the Lord starts to answer prayer. And it's prayer answered by Nehemiah sticking his neck out at a certain point. And as you look at what he actually did, we observe several elements of the actions that the Lord used to carry out his work. First of all, it was a courageous action on his part. Look with me at verse 1. "In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence, and the king said to me, 'Why is your face sad, seeing you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart.' Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Now, some people hold that Nehemiah deliberately put on a depressed look so that the king would notice him and ask him what the problem was. I find that hard to accept. It flies in the face of what seems to be a very sincere man, and also because of the overall setting in the court. The king would have expected his servants to act and respond in a way that was in keeping with whatever mood he was in. And if Nehemiah was all about wine and feasting, this may have actually been at a moment of feasting. The king would have expected for his servants to enter into the spirit of that, to be supportive of that, and not to draw attention to themselves as somehow being different or somehow not going along with what was taking place. To do otherwise would have endangered them, would have upset the king. Nehemiah, in that situation, says that he was very much afraid when the king asked him about his sad face. And I would imagine that that often happens, like it happens with us. He was not aware of the nonverbals that he was communicating by his countenance. Sometimes we are so distracted and so discouraged that it's like written all over our face. And we're aware of our pain, but we're not necessarily thinking that other people can read us and can see what's happening, something of what's happening inside. Nehemiah, during those 4 months, he wanted to make his request known to the king. He wanted something done about it, but it really would not have been appropriate for him to take the initiative and ask for what he's getting ready to ask here. He was waiting for a providentially arranged, very specific situation to where it was more natural for him to make the request. And it would have been received well if the king took the first step. He was waiting on the Lord in prayer to somehow work things out to start the conversation. And the time has finally come after all his agonizing. And he says he's overwhelmed by fear in that moment that he has so long awaited. I know what that feels like. To know that there is a job before you from the Lord, to want to do it, but internally to be so aware of your weakness and your inabilities that you tremble to take that step. By God's grace, Nehemiah pushes through the fear, and he forthrightly explains his dilemma there in verse 3. And he talks about what was going on in the city. Likewise, if you and I are to accomplish a work for the Lord, we have to take that first step of faith. Usually the other steps are easier, but it's that first step that's just excruciating. It's brutal to finally open my mouth to carry out the initial parts of what God has called me to do. Somebody said this: courage is not the absence of fear, but it is acting in the face of fear. And Nehemiah is very honest about the fear that was troubling him and how by God's grace he pushed back against it. And that brings us then to the second aspect, the second characteristic of his action here. And that it was a God-dependent action. So Nehemiah makes this statement about his homeland, and the king says, "All right, what are you asking for? What are you requesting?" And immediately, before saying anything, he says, "I pray to the God of heaven." Now, Nehemiah had been making very extensive prayers for months. We read about one of those. I don't think he says, hang on, king. And he gets on his knees and raises his hands to the Lord and goes on and on for half an hour. This is an on-the-spot, mental, kind of popcorn prayer that he raises up right before he says the next thing. And we're going to see that come up a number of other times in this book. Spurgeon said, "I always feel it well to put a few words of prayer between everything I do." Maybe you feel this way, but the older I get and the more complicated are the problems I face, the more I find myself doing this all the time, like all the time, in my heart. "God, I don't know what I'm doing. God, I am so needy of you. God, help me. Have mercy on me. Give me wisdom." And that verbalizing, even if it's just in your mind and heart, it keeps your activity for the Lord from being merely human activity or a self-reliant sort of courage. And this is the spirit that he has. And as he then goes on to speak, we see a lot of wisdom. This is a wise kind of action that he carries out here in the way that he phrases the request. Verse 5, "I said to the king, if it pleases the king, if your servant has found favor in your sight," notice how deferential and honoring he is to the authority, that's part of the wisdom, "that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it." So he makes his request. "I want to go back and rebuild the city." And it seems that that expression, how he puts it, "the city of my father's graves," is particularly strategic in how he is presenting his request. And you want to remember that Artaxerxes had been the very same person who had stopped the rebuilding of Jerusalem. It was going to take a significant consideration or persuasion to move upon him to do an about-face, to change his mind and say, "Okay, now you guys can rebuild the city," when nothing really had changed in the circumstances. I think "the city of my father's graves" was a good thought to lead into the request, because pagan people honored their deceased relatives. And they gave a lot of attention to beautifying and maintaining the graves of people in the past. Twice now, in verse 3 and here again in verse 5, Nehemiah mentioned that this is the city of my father's graves. And it is an appeal to something that for Artaxerxes would have been important, something he would have considered special and worth doing, that this isn't just my people, but this is about honoring my descendancy. He was appealing to something that this man already cared about. And then the king replies, the queen sitting beside him, verse 6, "How long will you be gone? When will you return? And so it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time." And it all gets resolved just so quickly there in one little line. But it was when he gave him information about the time. And you wonder, well, how did Nehemiah on the spot already have a time frame? Well, it seems that during those 4 months of praying, he was doing more than just praying. He was dreaming, we might say, and he was thinking in practical terms of how he could actually get this job done, even down to about how long it would take. And he had an immediate answer for the king. Artaxerxes would have been concerned about the time question because he didn't want to lose this trusted servant. He didn't want to be gone forever, and so Nehemiah gives him a reasonable time frame, and the king agrees. And then verse 7. He says something else. "If it pleases the king, let letters be given to me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and for the wall of the city and for the house that I shall occupy." And what you have there are more practical details that evidently, Nehemiah had already thought through what it was going to take in order to accomplish this task. He says, number one, I need safe passage through unfriendly territory. And I need building supplies for three structures. It's not just the walls. It is a fortress to protect the temple. That's necessary. Then the walls. And I'm even going to need a house for myself to have a place to live if I'm going to carry out this role effectively. That's a pretty tall order. And he's asking the king to fund him with the supplies needed to build all those things. And somebody might say, that's a bit extravagant. That's a bit presumptuous. Well, on a human level, maybe, but that brings us to our final thought here. that God grants his people favor with decision makers that they are operating under. And verse 8 rounds out the story as it goes on to say, the king granted me what I asked, as extravagant as it might have sounded, because the good hand of my God was upon me. That's how it all ends. The good hand of my God was upon me. Artaxerxes gave him everything he asked for. In fact, you go on to read in chapter 5, verse 14, and it says that Nehemiah wasn't just sent as a builder. He was appointed as a governor, and that he ended up serving in that role for 12 years. It may have been that things were going so well that the king said, you can stay longer, and kept giving him an extension, and it turned into 12 years. And then after he goes back to Persia, there's a second period in which he serves as a governor that's recounted in the latter part of Nehemiah. But all of that he explicitly attributes to the good hand of God. Proverbs 16:1 says, the plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. And that seems to be talking about what comes out of your own mouth, but I think it applies just as well in situations where whatever's going to happen in your life and whatever desires, they're dependent on what's coming out of somebody else's mouth. And you cannot go forward unless you have their approval, their support, their blessing. The answer of the tongue is from the Lord. Here's another verse from Proverbs. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. Now, I've actually quoted that more than once in our study of these exilic and post-exilic books, but I don't apologize for repeating it because it is such a vital assurance that we all depend upon, particularly at this time in our nation. That the things that happen in the highest of positions are not the result ultimately of human agendas or even human evil, but that God is sovereign and he is moving the heart of the king in whatever direction he wills at that particular time. God grants his people favor with those kinds of decision makers in our lives. Now, this story is designed to amaze us with what the Lord providentially accomplished as he answered Nehemiah's desperate prayers and worked to begin establishing the fame of his name in Jerusalem. And as we think of these things, at the very least, we try to apply this to our lives, at the very least, it should move us to worship the Lord for how he is able in such creative ways and in such diverse circumstances to advance what he intends to do for the blessing of his people, even in the midst of the bleakest political circumstances. It ought to move us to worship and adore and praise God that he is in this position and is carrying out his will, even in the highest place. But I would encourage us not to think only or even primarily about the big things like that. Encourage us to think about our individual lives and the difference that each of us can make as by faith we make use of our providentially ordained circumstances and throw ourselves into accomplishing some work for the Lord. Think about your circle in the providence of God. Your family is a part of that. But you have a neighborhood, you have a community, you have a church family, you have Christian people, you have non-Christian people that you are connected with in some way. That was not an accident. Is it possible that God is beginning to do a work through you in those layers of relationships? That he's beginning to do a work through you by doing a work in you as we consider the life of Nehemiah.